16, founding the Western Buddhist Order. In the last section but one, I related how, at the end of my first 2 years in England, I came to the conclusion that a new Buddhist movement was badly needed in Britain. Having paid my farewell visit to India, and having returned to England for good in March 1967, this time not at the invitation of the English Sangha Trust, I therefore set about creating that new Buddhist movement, and after a year of preliminary work, founded the Western Buddhist Order, which, in the opening words of this paper, came into existence on Sunday, April 7th, 1968, when in the course of a ceremony held at Centrehouse, London, 9 men and 3 women committed themselves to the path of the Buddha by publicly taking the 3 refuges and 10 precepts from me in the traditional manner. Thus, we have now come full circle, so to speak. We have returned to the point from which we set out, the point, that is to say, at which 12 people's understanding of what was meant by going for refuge coincided, at least to some extent, with the understanding at which I myself had arrived after traversing the stages in the history of my going for refuge so far described. But why did our new Buddhist movement take precisely the form it did? Why did I found an order rather than the usual society with its general membership, annual subscriptions, democratically elected office bearers, and so on? In order to answer this question, I shall have to go back a little. During my long stay in India, I had observed that the Buddhist movement there, for the most part, consisted, organizationally speaking, of a number of Buddhist societies, and that these societies did not always live up to their name. On looking into the matter more closely, I discovered that this was due not so much to ordinary human weakness as to the fact that some of the office bearers and other influential members of the societies in question were not even nominally Buddhists and had joined their respective organizations for reasons that had little or nothing to do with Buddhism. This was not to say that they were necessarily bad people. Some of them were very good people. But the fact that they were not committed Buddhists and made no serious effort to understand and practice the Dharma meant that the Buddhist societies of which they were a part could not be run with the energy and inspiration that alone could make them worthy of their name. The basic reason for this unsatisfactory state of affairs was that membership of these societies, as of others similarly constituted, was open to anyone who cared to fill in the form and pay the membership fee. During my long stay in India, I had therefore become convinced that it was not really possible for a Buddhist movement to consist, organizationally speaking, of a society or societies — the expression Buddhist society was in fact virtually a contradiction in terms — but that it had to consist, essentially, of a group or groups of committed Buddhists. And my more recent experiences in England had left me more convinced of this than ever. It was therefore an order, in the sense of a sangha or spiritual community, that I founded on Sunday, the April 7th, 1968. As must have been obvious to those who were present, though they may not have realized the significance of the fact at the time, this order of ours, the Western Buddhist Order, was what I subsequently termed a unified order. It was a unified order in that it consisted of both men and women who went for refuge to the same 3 jewels, observed the same 10 precepts, practiced the same meditations and other spiritual disciplines, and who were qualified, performed the same administrative and ministerial functions. The Western Buddhist Order was also a unified order in that it was envisaged as consisting of people of different lifestyles and different degrees of commitment to the 3 jewels. Since it was a unified order, and especially since it consisted of both men and women, the Western Buddhist Order represented something of a departure from Eastern Buddhist tradition, at least as that tradition was understood in some parts of the Buddhist world. In all other respects, however, it was fully traditional in structure, as I was careful to point out towards the end of my lecture on the idea of the Western Buddhist order and of Upasaka ordination, the first of the two lectures I gave on that historic day, when, after summarizing the history of Buddhism in Britain and explaining the meaning of going for refuge, I dealt with the four grades of ordination of which the Western Buddhist order was to consist. These four grades of ordination, representing four increasing degrees of commitment to the three jewels, were those of Upasaka Upasika, the lay brother or lay sister, the Maha Upasaka Upasika, the senior lay brother or lay sister, the novice Bodhisattva, and the bhikshu or monk. Since it was the Upasaka Upasika ordination that the 12 ordinants were to receive that evening, I naturally had more to say about this grade of ordination than about the three others, which in any case soon fell into desuetude. An Upasaka, or Upasika, was one who engaged in upasana, or religious practice. Literally, he was one who sat near a teacher, that is, who was a disciple. Thus, an Upasaka was not just a lay Buddhist, in the sense of a purely nominal follower of the Buddha's teaching. Though continuing to lead a secular life, he at the same time tries to purify himself with the help of 10 vows, 3 for body, 4 for speech, and 3 for mind. These vows were, 1-3, abstention from taking life, from taking the not giving, given, from sexual misconduct, by which body was purified. 4-7, abstention from false, harsh, and frivolous speech, as well as from slander and backbiting, by which speech was purified. And, 8-10, abstention from covetousness, animosity, and false views, by which mind was purified. Upasaka ordination consisted essentially in taking these 10 vows, preceded by the 3 refuges, or, as I had called them early in the lecture, the 3 commitments. An Upasaka member of the Western Buddhist order was also expected to be a vegetarian, or at least to make an effort to be one, to practice right livelihood, the 5th constituent of the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, and to lead a simple life, as well as to meditate every day, attend a class every week, and go on retreat every year. On a more mundane level, he or she was expected to give whatever practical help he could, whether financial or otherwise, to the new Buddhist movement, of which the Western Buddhist order was now the heart and center. These additional requirements were not embodied in any rule, but were left to the discretion of the individual Upasaka. Having dealt with your Upasaka ordination in this way, I emphasized that it represented a very definite degree of commitment indeed. Though the Upasaka grade was in one sense the lowest of the order's 4 grades of ordination, in another sense it was the most important, for it was the basis on which the whole structure rested, an insight that may well have foreshadowed the later absorption of the 2nd, 3rd and 4th grades of ordination into the 1st, and the renaming of that as the Dharmachari ordination. Foreshadowing or not foreshadowing, it was to the 3 remaining grades of ordination that I now turned. The Maha Upasaka, Upasika, the senior, literally great, lay brother or lay sister, was an Upasaka of several years of standing. He or she had a certain amount of understanding and experience of the Dharma and was able to help out with the giving of lectures and taking of classes. He was, however, still a householder in the sense of still having a family and a full-time job. The Bodhisattva, in the full traditional sense, was one who aimed at the attainment of enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. He was one who took the Bodhisattva vow, and in the Mahayana, the taking of this vow was associated with a definite ordination. In the context of the Western Buddhist order, the Bodhisattva was one who showed signs of possessing exceptional spiritual gifts, and who was only technically a layman. Though he might have a part-time job, he or she would function in a ministerial capacity. The bhikshu or monk was the celibate full-timer. He might devote himself to teaching the Dharma, to study and literary work, or to meditation, or to a combination of 2 or 3 of these. In any case, his material needs would be supplied by other members of the order, and by the general, that is the general Buddhist, public. I spoke of the bhikshu or monk, and not of the bhikshu or monk and the bhikshuni or nun, because it was widely believed in the Buddhist world that the tradition of bhikshuni ordination had died out many centuries ago and could not be renewed. With the absorption of the three higher grades of ordination in the first, and the emergence within the Western Buddhist order of anigarikas, or celibate homeless ones of both sexes, this ceased to be a problem for our new Buddhist movement, if indeed it had ever been one. Though the greater part of my lecture was devoted to explaining the meaning of going for refuge and dealing with the four grades of ordination, I also touched on a number of other topics. Apart from issues of a more general nature, such as the connection between Western Buddhism and the events of the age in which my audience and I were living, these included the difference between the academic study of Buddhism, an actual commitment to the three jewels, the importance of spiritual fellowship and spiritual community, and the inability of Buddhist societies to meet the growing needs of Western Buddhists, as well as the reasons that had led to the establishment of the Western Buddhist order. It had been established, I declared, to enable people to commit themselves more fully to the Buddhist way of life, to provide opportunities for spiritual fellowship, and to provide an organizational base for the propagation of Buddhism in the United Kingdom. I also took note, before describing the structure of the Western Buddhist order, of a difference of opinion on the subject of Sangha or spiritual community. There were, I said, two extreme views. According to one view, the Sangha consisted only of monks. The rest were not really Buddhist at all, their duty being merely to support the monks. Buddhism was in fact a purely monastic religion, and a Buddhist laity a contradiction in terms. According to the other view, the Sangha consisted of the entire population of a Buddhist country. Thieves, prostitutes, drunkards, and policemen, all were Buddhists. They were born Buddhists, and in my experience, born Buddhists knew nothing of Buddhism. These, then, were the two extreme views, one too narrow, the other too broad. So far as the Western Buddhist order was concerned, it was proposed to follow a middle way between them, as would be evident from its very structure. Having described this structure, and having said a few words about the friends of the Western Buddhist order, I concluded the lecture by saying that I had explained the idea of the Western Buddhist order and of Upasaka ordination in some detail because of its extreme importance and because it was probably the biggest step yet taken by British Buddhism. In the second of my two lectures of the day, on the Bodhisattva vow, I dealt with the Bodhisattva ideal, and particularly the Bodhisattva vow itself, as exemplifying the way in which we rose above the pairs of opposites, and in this connection gave a straightforward exposition of the arising of the will to enlightenment, the sevenfold puja, the four great vows, and the six paramitas. Thus, my second lecture was less closely connected with the actual ordination ceremony than was my first. Towards the end of it, I did, however, say a few words about the Bodhisattva ordination, which was, of course, the third grade of ordination in the Western Buddhist order. I also referred to the fact that I had myself taken the Bodhisattva ordination from Dharadu Rinpoche, whom I described as perhaps embodying the Bodhisattva ideal to a greater extent than any other person I had known. It was my hope, I concluded, that in course of time, a few people in Britain would be ready to take Bodhisattva ordination, in which case our Western Buddhist order would be well underway. But whether they took the Bodhisattva ordination or not, everybody present should try to imbibe the Bodhisattva spirit and echo the Bodhisattva vow in their own hearts. So far as I remember, the main reason for my speaking on the Bodhisattva vow that day, apart from the fact that the Bodhisattva ordination formed part of the structure of the Western Buddhist order, was that I wanted to emphasize the altruistic and other regarding aspect of Buddhism and of the Buddhist spiritual life. Though I had not yet explicitly identified the arising of the will to enlightenment as the altruistic dimension of going for refuge, I was well aware that in the individualistic and self-regarding atmosphere of British Buddhism, the act of going for refuge and therewith the Upasaka ordination was likely to be understood as possessing significance only for the person immediately concerned, and that it was therefore necessary to introduce a Mahayana element into the proceedings. It was almost as if having not as yet established a direct connection between the arising of the will to enlightenment and going for refuge, I at least wanted the Bodhisattva ideal to be around and ready to enter into the situation as soon as conditions permitted. The founding of the Western Buddhist Order was not only an important stage in the process whereby the significance and value of going for refuge became clear to me, it also marked the beginning of a new phase in that process. Though I had realized that going for refuge was the central act of the Buddhist life and that it meant organizing one's existence round the three jewels, that realization had so far found expression only in my personal life and in my writings and lectures, and even then only to a very limited extent. But now the situation was entirely changed. The 12 people who made up the Western Buddhist Order had taken the 3 refuges and 10 precepts from me, had been ordained as upasakas and upasikas by me, and their understanding of the meaning of going for refuge coincided with mine, at least partly. Like one lamp lighting a dozen others, I had been able to share with them my realization of the absolute centrality of the act of going for refuge, and henceforth that realization would find expression not in my life only, but also in theirs. Not that the realization in question was something fixed and final. It could continue to grow and develop and find expression in 100 ways as yet unthought of. Unfortunately, some founder members of the Western Buddhist Order found it difficult to appreciate this fact, or even to sustain their original commitment, and before long either resigned from the order or withdrew from active participation in its affairs. Their places were, however, soon filled, and more than filled, and I had the satisfaction of lighting first scores, then hundreds of lamps, and the still greater satisfaction of seeing them, together with those lamps that had burned undimmed from the beginning, grow brighter as my own lamp grew brighter. In other words, I had the satisfaction of knowing that in founding the Western Buddhist Order, I had founded a sangha or a spiritual community that not only shared my realization that going for refuge was the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life, but also shared in the person of at least some of its members my conviction that that realization itself was capable of continued growth and development. With the founding of the Western Buddhist Order, my own going for refuge thus became bound up with the going for refuge of a number of other people, so that from this time onwards, my history will be covering ground with which many order members are already familiar. In the sections that follow, I shall therefore be more selective and more succinct.